Radio Catskill, keeping you connected.
Hello.
We're the Wayne County Commissioners, and we'd like to wish everyone a very happy and safe holiday season. And we want to encourage you to consider one of the many job opportunities available at Wayne County Courthouse and elsewhere in the county operations.
Every county employee serves the residents of Wayne County. This could be the beginning of a career for a recent high school or college graduate.
Maybe you're new to the area or retired and want to work part-time. Please reach out to us and let us know what hours work best for you. We have openings in several departments, and we'll see if we can't find you an opportunity that provides more than just a salary.
If you are compassionate, dedicated, and looking for more, call 570-253-5706 or email jobs@waynecountypa.gov. Everyone is eligible to apply. This is Commissioner Brian Smith,
Commissioner Joe Adams,
and Commissioner Jocelyn Kramer wishing you all a healthy and happy 2022.
Paid for by Wayne County, PA.
Live from NPR News, I'm Giles Snyder. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has delivered a video message to the UK saying he believes this Christmas will be better than last year, despite the Omicron coronavirus variant that's driving a spike in infections.
And though the time for buying presents is theoretically running out, there is still a wonderful thing you can give your family and the whole country. And that is to get that jab, whether it's your first or your second or your booster, so that next year's festivities are even better than this year's.
Johnson spoke as Britain set a third straight day of record infections on Friday. His government has so far ruled out imposing new restrictions, saying there is uncertainty about the severity of Omicron. Airlines are warning that flight cancellations, largely blamed on staffing shortages driven by Omicron, could last through the weekend. In the U.S., airlines such as Delta and United have canceled hundreds of flights during the busy holiday travel period. The U.S. Navy says a ship originally headed to South America remains in port in Guantanamo Bay after sailors on board tested positive for COVID-19. NPR's Dave Mistich has more.
The Navy says all sailors on board the USS Milwaukee who have tested positive for the coronavirus, a portion of whom have exhibited mild symptoms, are isolated from other crew members. In a news release issued Friday evening, the Navy says the ship's crew is 100% vaccinated and that a specific COVID variant has yet to be determined. In mid-December, the USS Milwaukee departed for a regularly scheduled deployment to the U.S. Fleet Area of Operations, which includes the Caribbean Sea as well as the Atlantic and Pacific Ocean around Central and South America. The Navy says the ship is currently in port at Naval Station Guantanamo Bay for a scheduled visit. Dave Mistich, NPR News.
NASA's James Webb Space Telescope has started what will be about a million-mile journey into space. NPR's Neil Greenfield Boyce reports that the long-awaited telescope safely lifted off from a launch site in South America this Christmas morning.
The most powerful telescope ever put into space now has to travel to the spot where it will observe the universe. It also has to unfold all of its major components, like its mirror and sunshield, without a hitch. That's why the next couple of weeks will be a nerve-wracking time for astronomers. Bill Nelson is the administrator of NASA.
We've always known that this project would be a risky endeavor. But of course, when you want a big reward, you have to usually take a big risk.
If all goes well, the James Webb Space Telescope will be able to see light from galaxies that formed soon after the universe started, nearly 14 billion years ago. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
And this is NPR News.
Your NPR station for the Catskills in Northeast Pennsylvania. This is Radio Catskill.
Hi, my name is Patrice Rubio. I'm a producer with WJFF Radio Catskill. Welcome to another edition of the Reporters Roundtable. Joining me today is journalist Liam Mayo of The River Reporter, Chris Raleigh of the Shawangunk Journal, Joseph Abraham from the Sullivan County Democrat, and Philip Pantuso from the River Newsroom. Today we'll be looking back at the year that was, 2021. One of the big topics that we covered here on the Reporters Roundtable is cannabis. The deadline for when towns and villages in New York have to decide whether or not they want to opt out of having a dispensary or anti-consumption site within their town is coming up December 31st. Some towns have voted already on it. Some have not. Liam, since cannabis has become legal this past year for recreational use for adults over 21, what has happened this past year and what have you discovered while covering this topic?
It has definitely been a contentious issue throughout the past year. It's something that every town has gotten the chance to decide on. And it's also something a lot of towns have held the opportunity to talk about. Debates in town board meetings month after month, where people just get to sort of air their views and the pros and cons of cannabis. And in some towns, that has led to the town eventually deciding to opt out of cannabis. I believe Coshecton chose to opt out of the program for licensing and ban both dispensaries and smoking lounges, largely on the grounds that the rules for the cannabis industry are still sort of being written. So they don't really want to opt into something that they don't know a lot about yet or that isn't really clear yet. And then you have other towns like Highland recently decided to opt into the program or decided to pass by the opportunity to opt out of the program. And I believe that one of the primary things they were talking about is, oh, it'll be good for business. It's good to have businesses like cannabis dispensaries in their towns. Sort of an interesting town I've been covering with it is Tustin. It's been one where people have really come out in force on both sides. There are people who say, we don't want pot in our town. We don't want this kind of business and we don't want this kind of cliché coming to our town. And then there are people who come out and say, this is going to be really good for business. We sort of need this to be attractive as a destination for entrepreneurs and for small business owners. And in Tustin, the board itself decided to opt out. So they have passed a law to opt out, but that decision is going to local referendum. So the decision to opt out is subject to permissive referendum. And in Tustin, that referendum is going to happen. They have a petition with enough votes to hold that referendum. And that's going to be next November. We're at the general election. So even though the deadline for towns deciding is November, the end of the year, there's still in Tustin a little left to be seen about it going into 2022.
Yeah, this topic is very fluid. Things are evolving and changing. And Chris, in your area, you have something different that's happening in Sullivan County. Sullivan County, we're mostly talking about dispensaries and on-site consumptions. But in your area, you actually have a grow facility coming.
So two things. So just going on the local stuff first, Village of Ellenville has decided not to opt out, so they're opted in. And that's pretty much clear. And it was pretty much the same sort of divisions that we've seen everywhere else. In Ellenville, the pro-business side was dominant. What we're seeing is going to have a special meeting today, later on today, 5 o'clock, to discuss whether or not to opt out. And it's a public hearing this time, so it'll bring in the public a little bit and we'll see. I mean, I expect Wawarsing will have a contentious debate. Now, on the other side of it, the biggest news really is that they're headquartered in Chicago. Cresco Labs, which is a very large cannabis producing and distributing firm, have decided to by the former Schrade, former Channel Master site just outside Ellenville and erect a 380,000 square foot cannabis growing facility. We've seen, you know, video of enormous interior spaces filled to the far horizon with enormous cloned cannabis plants, all 9 feet tall and 8 feet wide, growing out of blocks of material. They don't use soil. It's been a very interesting kind of introductory course in how to grow large amounts of cannabis indoors. Anyway, they are coming. They are at planning board tonight, and they're bringing in a new sketch plan. Yeah, it's bringing in a sketch plan, and they have a new name. They're Valley. Their LLC for this operation is Valley Agriceuticals, which is kind of sweet. kind of, you know, modern thing. And we'll see, you know, what they have to say. The sketch plan will be interesting because they, while the site there, the property that they want to buy is pretty spacious. It's got like 79 acres. And I don't know if you know the area around Ellenville or along 209, but this property runs basically from a stream, the Fantine Kill, right across to the Shoprite and the Shoprite Plaza. But at one corner, it dips down into the floodplain, and there's wetlands there. And so once you start to try to put a 380,000 square foot facility into that space, and you don't want to reuse the concrete slab on which the Channel Master and the Schrade factory sat, you know, you now all of a sudden you have a little bit of a space problem. And we'll see what their sketch map looks like tonight, what's they're going to try and do. Because I know the DEC would not be terribly happy with losing any wetlands, you know, although they could negotiate that kind of thing. But that's been the big exciting story, because Cresco Labs is a major company. They're already in New York. They have medicinal outlets down in the city in Long Island. They had a medicinal grow facility in the hamlet of Wallkill. And what they're talking about for Ellenville would probably bring in at least, 300 jobs, and pretty well-paying jobs. And all over the map would be... There'd be broom pushing jobs. There'd be bud tending jobs. They don't use the word bud, by the way. It's flower. Flower tending jobs. And, I mean, this brings back concepts like flower power, if you recall that. Man, you're probably not old enough. But anyway, there's a lot of interesting kind of, you know, stuff going on there. Anyway, those kind of jobs plus executive jobs. And, their representatives have mentioned that people have, joined, or been employed first off as someone just working in an agricultural room, taking care of plants. And then they've become executives and, moved up the ladder into, you know, much better paying jobs, but all their jobs pay well. And they're sort of talking about an average of sort of like 45, 50 grand. So this is a good paying job for our area. And, you know, it could be a major economic shot in the arm for not just Ellenville, because obviously people will drive to these jobs, but the whole area, and even over in Sullivan County, I would expect there'd be people. So that's been the big news on cannabis. Meanwhile, as I said, Ellenville has chosen to opt in, and with all the places opting out around us, like Mamikating, Crawford, places in Sullivan County, it may be that Ellenville will be the destination. Oh, Middletown opted out, right? Middletown opted out. I mean, that's a big market.
Wow, so surprising.
When people are, yeah, I know, but when people are deciding, you know, where are we going to go to score some whatever, you know, flour or other products, they may well come to Ellenville, which, you know, is also undergoing something of a renaissance. You know, just about every commercial property in the village has been bought in the last 18 months.
That's actually one of the concerns that I hear in some of the public hearings that I attended on cannabis, is that if a town doesn't do it right now, they might be missing out on some economic funds coming into their town, and they just might go elsewhere if they don't have it. Philip, like I said, this is such a fluid topic. What are you finding in your reporting on cannabis? You know, taking a look back this past year.
Yeah, I mean, that to me has been kind of the main story that we've been paying attention to. Is when the MRTA was passed back in March, it kind of set out pretty admirable goals and a kind of mechanism for funding it, but there was a lot of sort of details that were punted to the Office of Cannabis Management and the Cannabis Control Board. And then for various reasons, the staffing of that was just really delayed. You know, the state's Cannabis Control Board didn't have its first meeting until October. And you know, Liam mentioned this earlier, a lot of towns have already been having, by that point, had already been having discussions about whether to opt in or opt out for months. And without exactly knowing how this rollout's going to work and what and what all the sort of guardrails are going to be. They're making that decision partly in the dark. And we still, you know, we still don't know everything. We still don't know the entire regulatory framework yet. So the, you know, I think, and I may not be completely up to date on this, but the state cannabis advisory board still needs to be appointed, which is going to be appointed by the governor, the Senate, and the Assembly. And that's going to be responsible for administering this community grants reinvestment fund, which is part of the sort of social justice component of the bill. So, you know, long story short, there's still a lot we don't really know about how this is going to be implemented.
I'll just chime in to say that that cannabis advisory board is the one thing we haven't written about yet because it doesn't exist. But the cannabis control board, they are, you know, I mean, this is not going to be easy because there's a lot of complications on a national level. As I understand it, the illegal cannabis that's being consumed in New York City now is coming from California. And California is an example of what not to do. Make it all so expensive and so difficult in regulation terms that nobody bothers to be legal. Everybody just grows and sells illegally and they just say, hey, bust us. And they do, but it doesn't mean anything because it's only a $500 fine now. So every day, large numbers of 18-wheelers are heading across the country towards the East Coast carrying illegally grown Californian cannabis, something that the Cannabis Control Board has to keep in mind, I think.
Yeah. I mean, one of many things the board has to keep in mind. You know, one of the reasons why it took this bill so long to get passed in the first place is that New York was really trying to look at what other states, where they had gone wrong, essentially. And, you know, one of the things that happened in California is they essentially set up the market to barred small growers from participating. And so you've just had this flourishing black market there. The state has really tried to pick and choose the best policies and write the bill in such a way to avoid, you know, creating a kind of big cannabis industry that its small farmers and its sort of impacted populations aren't able to participate in, which is admirable, but it also makes it incredibly complicated to stand up that industry when there are there's so many sort of constituencies that you have to appease within that.
It's not just THC cannabis. Remember, it's hemp as well. You know, a brief discussion with someone who's in line with that cannabis control board, and they say, you know, they're talking about agriculture on the one side of it and dispensaries on the other side of it, and they haven't even really begun to think about what would happen in terms of consumption lounges or whatever the hell they're going to call these things, you know, if they actually exist. Because I don't think, I mean, put this out to everybody, I don't think that the smoking model, smoking, you know, herbal whatever, right, is going to be the long-term consumption path for this new, relatively, as it were, intoxicant. Something that's more like a drink is likely to replace the smoking model, I think. But that's 10 years down the road, maybe right. 5. But immediately, can you imagine anything? I mean, you can't smoke indoors in New York State. You right. can't smoke a cigarette. I just don't see that as a model. So we'll see. But anyway. They're making up the rules as we go along and trying to fly the plane at the same time.
Definitely true. Definitely true. There's a lot of unknowns. And Joe, the county budget was just passed recently. And one of the things about cannabis has been brought up was the revenue that's going to be brought in. In your reporting in legislature, has cannabis been a topic there? Has it been sort of debated or sort of just sort of has been a sort of an afterthought and waiting to the last minute to do something about it?
I've seen absolutely nothing since I've taken over in August as far as them even speaking about it. This particular legislature group has had enough things that they've been focusing on that I don't know if that's just been something that's an afterthought, or maybe they're trying to see what's going to happen with the 15 townships and the different villages in Sullivan County. But no, it hasn't come up at the county legislature yet. And I didn't recall in the budget process plans as far as revenue, but yeah, I don't know how soon any of this is going to take place anyway, because, you know, it's great if a town can opt in, but they've said that it's harder to get a license than to get accepted into Harvard. So if you know, I think at that point, before we actually see who gets licenses and when properties are going to actually come about, I don't really know how soon that counties or towns will even begin to see economic shares of that money. So, but no, but as far as townships go, the two that I cover, Calicoon opted out because they were mainly concerned with the enforcement of it, driving while under the influence, that particular side of it. And the town of Rockland, which is Livingston Manor, Roscoe, they wanted to, they took no action, so they're opting into both. And the town board has mentioned Livingston Manor as a possible good place because they recently had a rebirth sort of themselves in a much smaller way than Ellenville because it's a little bit smaller of a community, but a lot of new businesses. And so that's something, a place that they're looking at. But to your original point, the county is not, to my knowledge, discussed it yet. So
you're listening to the Reporters Roundtable on Radio Chatskill. We're joined by Liam Mayo, the River Reporter, Chris Raleigh with the Shawangunk Journal, Joseph Abraham from the Sullivan County Democrat, and Philip Pantuso from the River Newsroom. Joe, looking at legislature, staying on legislature for this past year, it's been very contentious. I know you just took over that legislature beat for the Democrat mid-year. If you just take folks back on this past year and what has happened with the legislature and the public.
Sure. So last year, at the end of the year, they recently did it at their last meeting of the full board for the year. The legislators went in a circle and discussed sort of, their last end of year thoughts. This particular group, I know last year was talking about needing to work together and such. And what's happened is since 2 years ago, since they took, there's sort of been a divide between the newly elected legislators and the incumbents that won re-election within the legislature. Looking at the year as a whole, there's been lots of different debates. Big thing the year started, the care center at Sunset Lake, they chose the company that would be the consultant who would manage it for the next 20 years. And they chose Infinite Care. There were three different companies that were in the running for the finals. McGuire Group, there was the Grand, which owns a bunch of nursing homes across the state. And Infinite Care ended up winning out. Fast forward to the fall, I think it was September, they finally signed a consulting agreement between the two sides. There was some controversy because when the care center, which was a county-owned property, ownership was transferred to the LDC over a year ago, nonprofit status or the tax-exempt status, for a better word, did not automatically get carried over with the town of Liberty. And because the LDC, according to the Liberty assessor, did not put in a request or go through that process, property was assessed the $226,000 school tax bill in September, which ultimately the county gave the LDC money to pay. And it was later announced by the county that Infinite Care would reimburse the county for that amount. But because of the tax exempt status of the, of the nursing home, in addition to some omit property taxes, a delegation of county employees, it was the chairman of the legislature, Rob Doherty, county attorney Mike McGuire, and two other county employees went to a board of assessment review meeting in the town of Liberty later on in the fall. I believe it was November. And after that meeting, the town of Liberty sent some correspondence to the county with some allegations of that meeting as far as the alleged behavior of the county delegation that was present. A couple of those things was the town of Liberty assessor claimed that the chairman called her the C word. And they also talked about some bullying behavior from the county attorney. And then afterwards, the legislators decided, many of them spoke up in support of having a third party independent investigation as far as the events that went on that day. And that's currently being looked into. But throughout this whole process through the year, there's been a lot of debate between, like I said, the two groups that I'd mentioned, the ones who were the incumbents, and also, those who were newly elected 2 years ago. And there's been this divide that exists, last winter into the spring, because of some different events, the four incumbent people who were reelected legislators actually called for the chairman to resign. You were mentioning the interactions with the public. There has been a contingent of public members, many of them refer to themselves as the, quote, Truth Squad. That is their name. And they show up to legislation meetings. They, constantly public comment and are very critical of the legislative body and particularly its leadership. So it's been interesting. And once again, there's been talk amongst the legislature about, working together as we end the new year. And calls for wanting to do that. But the big thing, I guess, looking towards the future and recapping that whole shebang is that in the middle of a four-year legislature term, they go to reorganize. And they'll be doing that in January. And there's two people that are currently seeking the chair position that will be voted on by the nine legislators. And that's the current chairman, Rob Doherty. Joe Perillo, who's the District 7 legislator, is also putting his hat in the ring. He's one of those four incumbents on the other side who, that were reelected a few years ago. So that'll be interesting to see how it plays out. Currently, looks like they each have four votes or four, support on each side. The one question will be Alan Sorensen, who is another one of the legislators. And I haven't been able to get a hold of him yet, but I know that his vote will probably be the deciding one because, nine people. So whatever he decides will be the 5-4 that will, be needed to secure the chairship in that reorg. But, taking it back around, the county recently passed the budget. Keep too much of the WJFF listeners too much, but some of the highlights are $12 million for road and bridge work, $4 million to cover county costs associated with the care center at Sunset Lake. They also started Move Sullivan, which was a bus service to parts of the county. So there's just some money allocated to kind of expanding that. There's a survey going on right now that the county is seeking input on. And depending on what that survey finds, they'll take that info in their works to try to expand that. Because public transportation has been an issue in our county for a while, and in the rural area. Tends to be a thing. So there's a lot of interesting things happening this year at county government. That's my recap of as far as what, will be the thing. We'll see how the leadership goes. And there'll be redistricting soon, the legislative districts. That's a big thing for next year based on census results. So those are some other issues that the legislature will have to deal with next year.
Liam, one of the things that Joe mentioned is infrastructure. And one of the things that you've been covering is the Skinner's Bridge, Skinner's Falls Bridge. You spoke about it at length at the local edition, and you spoke at length a couple of times here on the Reporters Roundtable. If you give a recap of what's happening with that bridge and sort of what's in store for 2022.
So that's a project that's had a decent amount of progress over the past year and looks to have a decent amount of progress made in 2022. The Skinner's Falls Bridge is a historic 1902 bridge that connects Skinner's Falls in New York and Milanville in Pennsylvania. And it's been closed several times in recent years for emergency repairs. And the weight limit that the bridge is posted at has dropped down from, I believe, 9 tons to 4 tons. And back in 2019, there was an investigation that determined that there was just some structural damage to the bridge, and it had to be closed. And since then, the Pennsylvania Department of Transportation has been working with a few partners to come up with a plan to either restore or rehabilitate or replace the bridge with something that can get people across the river in that location. It's an issue that's attracted a lot of public comment. The bridge is a very historic bridge. There are elements in its construction that I believe are unique or fairly unique among bridges that still exist. And there's a large contingent wanting the bridge to be restored. A lot of public comment revealed in survey processes that PennDOT has put out has advocated for the bridge's restoration. And there's some concern from advocates that PennDOT is pushing for a replacement of the bridge with something that can hold a greater weight limit. And it's still a little too early in the planning process for PennDOT to come out and say what they want to do with the bridge. It's been over the past year just gathering comments and doing surveys and studies. But recently they released a purpose and need document, which is a draft that is supposed to guide the discussion of alternatives going forward. So basically, any alternatives for what will happen to that bridge have to meet the stated purpose and need for a bridge in that location. And one of the needs stated was the need for emergency vehicles to cross in that location. And they specifically stated that those emergency vehicles, like fire trucks and ambulances and river rescue vehicles, can be weigh up to 31 tons, which seems to contrast a little bit with the bridge's current or original weight limit of 9 tons. So I think going into 2022, that will still sort of be the divide, and that'll still be the discussion about whether there needs to be a new bridge in that place with this sort of greatly expanded weight capacity, or whether the historic value of the bridge is a little more important or deserves to be maintained, or if there's some way that they can do both. I'm not a bridge engineer. I don't know what the capabilities of restoring the structure that currently exists there are, but the current purpose and need document is under a 30-day public comment period. I believe that closes January 8th. And after that, it'll start picking up going into 2022, and we'll see what kinds of alternatives they're thinking about for what they want to do with the bridge.
Infrastructure is definitely something that's in the news, you know, especially with this infrastructure bill that's being held up in Congress right now. This is Radio Catskill. You're listening to the Reporters Roundtable. We are joined by Leah Mayo of the River Reporter, Chris Raleigh of the Shawanoga Journal, Joseph Abraham from the Sullivan County Democrat, Philip Pantuso from the River Newsroom, and we're taking a look back at what the year that was. Chris, looking on your side of Catskills, take us back this past year, and what have you seen in your reporting as far as the development that's going on, economic development that's going on in your neck of the woods?
Sure. Well, development actually is purchasing. Has real estate has been the story of the year, but some actual development or redevelopment has actually begun on South Main Street, where a brick building right next to an old-fashioned type of Dollar General. And it's a strange sight because the two buildings are on the same lot. But this old brick building has been collapsing for decades, and it was getting dangerous. And that's been taken down. And so that lot is being redeveloped, and the Dollar General is being made a modern one, which will be much larger and have more parking and look like all the other Dollar Generals. So that's actual development. That's actually happening. Everywhere else, properties have been bought. Plans are being made. A certain amount of energy has come into the village planning board on this or that. But as yet, we don't see any brick and mortar kind of stuff happening in Ellenville, although it should soon. And of course, the biggest thing, other than the Cresco Labs on the northern end, which is actually sited in Wawarsing, is on the southern end is the redevelopment potential of the former Neverly Resort, which has been basically just a cluster of ruins for the last decade, and has now, well, it's complicated. I don't know if it's actually been bought. It's in the middle of being bought, and as you know, anything of that scale involving millions and millions and a complicated property covered in buildings, the negotiations go on, you know, as long as the Paris Peace Accords. I mean, it goes on and on and on, you know. It's crazy. We still don't know exactly what's happening there, but except that whenever we speak to those people, they're very upbeat, and they think it was all going to happen, but we don't know exactly when. That will be enormous. That will be another of these things, like the Cresco Labs, which will affect the whole region. Having a new kind of resort, a luxury travel resort perhaps, put into that site will be something that will resonate right through to the whole southwest corner of Ulster County and across into Sullivan. So that's the biggest thing. But in the village itself, buildings in the very center of the village have been bought. We're waiting to see what the new owners will do. There's a lot of space, a lot of things that they could do. And it's one of those kind of interesting moments. Everyone's waiting to see what is going to go into the cup. You know, it's sort of like it's under the spigot. What's coming out? You know, and nobody really knows at this point. But you know, we live in hope that there'll be really good things, and it will all be a benefit. One thing that many people ask me about, there's a building on Main Street, on the corner of Main Street and Canal. It's a brick building. It was originally the Ellenville First Bank, or the first bank, and then it became the Ellenville National Bank. And then that bank moved across the street to a new building. And this nice brick building, dating from somewhere in the early 20th century, was then a youth center. And then that shut because it was expensive. And it's just sat empty for a long, long time. And now that's been bought by the same people or a different LLC that are negotiating for the Neverly. And we wait to see with bated breath what they plan to do with this building, because it could be an incubator, which is the sort of thing that a lot of people have wondered about for Ellenville, and probably for other villages and other towns. A space where somebody wanting to start a business can rent a couple of desks, get a phone line in, do Zoom calls, do all of that sort of thing. It could be a really huge impetus to entrepreneurial activity in the village. But we'll see. Right now, these buildings have been bought, and we wait to see. We wait to see what comes into the planning board.
When it comes to economic development, one of the things that it does affect is the environment. Philip, how has 2021 been for the environment and climate in our listening area?
How has 2021 been for the climate in this area? A profound and scary question. I don't know how to answer that exactly. Certainly, we saw record or near record heat in this region and big flooding and storms, especially this past summer. I think, you know, the big climate story from this year, and this is going to continue to be the case in 2022, I think, is seeing how the state is going to implement the fairly ambitious decarbonization goals that it set forth in the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act, the CLCPA, in 2019. So that piece of legislation essentially set forth like pretty ambitious goals to get to net zero carbon emissions and 85% reduction in gross emissions by 2050. But it didn't really have a plan within that to implement it. So similar to what we were talking about earlier with the MRTA, an ambitious and kind of right-headed policy goal, but without the kind of like mechanism to enact it. So the state's Climate Action Council, which is this 22-member board that is charged with creating the plan, implementation plan to meet those goals, just this past week released the draft scoping plan for that. And that is going to be debated all through 2022. And a final action plan will be finalized, I think, in January 2023. And that is going to end up wielding influence over essentially every aspect of how state government operates in New York. And there are a lot of components that are set forth in the CLCPA, definitions like what is an impacted community, how are we going to restructure components of our energy infrastructure and our economy to get to where we need to go. And we're already starting to see this play out, I think, here in 2021. One of the big things we've been reporting on at the river is you've already seen some sort of local battles where big energy developers are trying to come in and put in utility scale renewable infrastructure. What this has kind of looked like, I mean, one story we ran back in September looks at a proposal in Copake from a California based company or a Chicago based company called Hecate LLC. And their proposal is to essentially build a gigantic solar array across 480 acres in the community, which will power 60 megawatts of solar power capacity. And there's been quite a lot of pushback on the local level from folks who acknowledge that climate change is a problem and that we need to take swift action for it, but don't want you know, a field of solar panels in their view shed. And I'm, you know, you can understand why that might be the case. You know, in the past, these decisions about where we place our utility infrastructure were mostly made at the expense of poor people and people of color, where we would put refineries essentially in their neighborhoods. So this becomes like an infrastructure question too. And I think that's going to be the big battle here. Like everybody agrees, I think, or everybody can agree that we need to take swift action, but hammering out the details about what that looks like exactly and specifically where it goes, I think there's going to be a lot of fighting about that. And we're already starting to see it here in 2021.
One good point that you are bringing up there is the effects on economic growth has on the community. I'm originally from the Bronx, and I'm, you know, reading articles recently about the effect Robert Moses had on the Bronx, the negative effects that Robert Moses had on the Bronx, and how they were building and expanding the Bronx, but really at the expense of the low-income and minority population there. And perfect example is the Cross Bronx Expressway, which I live really a stone's throw away from for over 30 years. And that really just tore the Bronx in half and displaced families and neighborhoods were just decimated because of eminent domain, and because they were minorities, because they were low income, they were just not really thought of. So I'm really glad you brought up that point.
One more note on that even. I think, you know, one of the things we're also starting to see is the state more or less stick to its principles there. So in late October, you know, there had been a proposal to expand the Danskammer power plant, which runs on natural gas outside of Newburgh. And that was denied by the DEC on the basis that it didn't demonstrate compliance with the requirements of the CLCPA. And of course, in November, one of the statewide ballot proposals that did pass was the Environmental Rights Amendment, which grants the New Yorkers the right to clean air, water, and healthful environment. Not exactly clear what that means, but it's now a sort of constitutional right of New Yorkers, and something that will enable people. You know, one legal expert we spoke to about this says that one way that could benefit people is you then have standing as a citizen to bring suit if that right is violated by, let's say, you know, a power plant in your neighborhood or something like that. So we're seeing progress, I think, toward actually implementing, you know, these more ambitious goals of the CLCPA, but there's a long way to go.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. Chris, you have some thoughts?
Well, I could just chime in quickly. You know, at that local level, solars, which is, you know, the one we mostly see in terms of you know, new energy infrastructure, we have the erection of 20 megawatt solar array on Department of Corrections land, just in the town of Owosing, just north of Ellenville. And there's an unspoken threat to another parcel of land just up the road a little further, which had a prison farm on it, Colony Farm. And that's a beautiful piece of like about 540 acres that stretches up into the Catskills. I mean, it stretches into the Vernoy Forest and on and on and on. And there's concern that DOCCS owns that, and they don't have to talk to the town or negotiate with the county or anything. They're a state level agency. They can do what they want. And if they want to be sure of being on the right side with the governor, and they will be looking to, you know, set up more solars. And there's a certain amount of concern in the town of Owosing that they don't do it again on a very visible place on a very important piece of land. The solar array on what was once called the cornfield by near the prison is startlingly ugly and destroys a glorious view of the Shongum Ridge from Route 209. And I do believe that in the town of Owosing, the sense is they have donated. They've given that beautiful piece of land has been taken, and that they should be let off the hook for any more. I'm surprised to hear that there was one that was 60. I mean, 60 megawatts, that's enormous. And, I'm just trying to think, that's the sort of thing you could see put on Colony Farm. There's space, but it would be a real blow, I think, to the town of Wawarsing. But it's this balancing act. Everybody knows that we're shifting to this. The state has made its commitment to do this, right? And they're not going to have more, coal-fired plants. They're going to have more solars. Who's going to get them? And now, since we don't have poor communities of color or Spanish language or anything like that to drive expressways through now on this one, this is an issue that's going to affect rural people who are overwhelmingly, I think the American term is Caucasian, which is a strange term. But anyway, it's going to affect white people, let's face it. And they have a different sense of things. And this will be interesting to see how this plays out. I suspect there are going to be a lot of pretty intensive battles over the next 5 to 10 years, especially if companies come in with dreams, perhaps, of setting up 60 megawatt facilities. I mean, that's huge. That is enormous.
This is Radio Chatskill, and you're listening to the Reporters Roundtable. I'm Patricio Rubio, and I'm joined by Lee Mayo, the River Reporter, and Chris Rowley of the Shawanagan Journal, Joseph Abraham from Sullivan County Democrat, Philip Pontuso from the River Newsroom, and we're taking a look back on what the year that was. We're wrapping up here. Anything else that we have not mentioned that you want our listeners to know about? Joe, how about you?
Yeah, I would just say that I guess ending on a positive note on my end is there's a lot of interesting projects in the works here in the area, ecotourism and various other developments to watch. And then also one big topic, and I had some technical difficulties earlier, so my apologies if someone already mentioned it. But on the environmental front, in February, fracking banned in the Delaware River Basin, which was a pretty big environmental story for the year. So I think we're in our society, it's interesting because there's always been this pull with Sullivan County with wanting more development, trying to protect the beauty and natural resources that we have here. And I see that sort of continuing. But economic development looks pretty good so far in the county. Sullivan County's been leading private sector job growth in the Mid-Hudson region for year over year for a little bit. So last couple months. So that's something to look into, I guess, into 2022. So, but other than that, I just hope everyone has a happy holiday and is safe amidst the sort of the rising COVID cases, which have been a cause for concern. So.
And how about you, Liam?
Yeah, I would just make mention sort of on the solar conversation of the town of Bethel as one way in which these conversations are happening and like a lot of people's perspectives are being or where it's happening. It's going well for the most part, I think. The Bethel earlier in the year had a ribbon cutting for a 6.1 megawatt solar array on, I believe, some land owned by a farmer on 17B. And that was a project that put New York over the 3 gigawatts of solar, a 3 gigawatts of solar milestone earlier in the year. And they're just now starting construction on a new solar array on the town's capped landfill. It's land that they couldn't use for any other purpose. So have been partnering with this company to create a land solar array there. So while I think There are definitely concerns with utility scale solar and bigger projects taking away people's rights to their land or to their view sheds or harming their natural environment. I think at least on the smaller scale level where towns or individuals can collaborate on more ground level projects, there is a lot of room to work with people and there's a lot of room for little bits of growth, which won't sort of fix the problem that we're having in terms of climate change and renewable energy, and it won't get us where we need to be, but it's every little bit helps.
One of the immediate effects that I'm noticing is that with all this push towards renewable energy and solar panels that are actually going up now in our county is that renewable energy and like solar energy and wind energy is now part of the everyday language. It's part of the everyday conversation now. And it's not so strange for people to discuss this. So that's one of the sort of the positive things I'm seeing with all this push towards renewable energy. And Philip, anything else you want our listeners to know about that we haven't discussed?
Yeah, just briefly want to echo Liam's point about how the solar conversation on the local level, I think, is going better. We wrote a couple of months ago about community choice aggregation, which essentially lets towns have bulk purchasing power. And there's, I think, a dozen or so in the mid-Hudson Valley that are participating in programs run by this company called Joule Community Power. And they're opt-out, so you get more buy-in that way, obviously. Bigger picture, I guess I would be remiss if I didn't do a little bit of self-promotion for the river. We're running a membership campaign through the end of the year. Our membership program, starts at $5 a month and gets you access to some special newsletters and free events that we do. And it's hugely critical to our functioning as a newsroom. It's one of our main revenue sources. So you can read more about that on therivernewsroom.com. Click on support at the top. And I hope everybody has a happy holiday season.
Yes, Seth, thank you. Chris, any last words before we go? The year 2021, I know you covered a lot of topics already, but any last words for our listeners?
Well, there was one thing which we haven't discussed, which I've written about a number of times, because this is, of course, a rural area, which is invasive plants and animals. They continue to invade. There are some spectacular examples. Up there in the Delaware, the Japanese knotweed has taken complete control, and there's any number of other invasives. So that's something a lot of people can actually do something about. If they have those plants on their land, they can take them out. It can give you something to do at weekends. It involves an upper body workout sometimes, hauling them out, cutting them, digging them out. And then there's the really sneaky stuff. I just wrote about this 2 weeks ago. There's an invasive Asian earthworm, three species actually, but two that are showing up here. And this is the assault on us by the humble, the small and the apparently very powerful. These earthworms devour the top layer of the ground. They eat all the leaf litter and the fertile humus that accumulates there. And it never, therefore they choke out the other worms and they choke out everything else because they consume the food of the future. So the Catskill invasive species people are looking at this with some anxiety. The DEC is now looking at it with a lot of anxiety, and we may see this may become the EAB of the next couple of years. If you remember the EAB, the emerald ash borer, it didn't seem like anything 10 years ago. The first time I wrote about it was like cute little green bugs from Japan. So what? Now, a couple of billion ash trees later, when everybody has a few in their backyard and they cost about $2,000 to $6,000 to take it down and get rid of, it's become a major problem. So, let's hope that one, that these Asian jumping worms don't become something like that.
It's not
exactly a happy Christmas thing, but yeah.
Yes, definitely. Thank you so much for joining us. My name is Patricio Robile. You were listening to the Reporters Roundtable. I was joined by Liam Mayo, the River Reporter, Chris Raleigh of the Shawangunk Journal, Joseph Abraham from Sullivan County Democrat, and Philip Pantuso from the River Newsroom. And we were taking a look back at the year 2021. I just want to thank everyone again for joining me again. Thank you for joining me this past year. We touched on some topics that were big this past year, but I think one of the biggest topics that we haven't touched on is COVID. And I did that for a reason, because COVID has been in the news every day and we do cover it on the local edition a lot and other programs. So I wanted to sort of focus on other issues that were happening in 2021. But of course, COVID is still the biggest story of 2021. New York State is seeing record number of positive daily cases also is the same as happening here in Sullivan County. So I'm sure that's going to be one of the biggest news stories for 2022, whether we are going to ever come out of this storm of COVID. We have the vaccine. We have the booster shot. As this time of this recording, the FDA just approved a pill from Pfizer to help with COVID infection. And also, we'll see how cannabis will play out in 2022, as the licenses roll out, as on-site consumption sites open up, and as dispensaries open up, we can see how the regulations will play out and how law enforcement agencies will deal with the new regulations. One of the main concerns that law enforcement has had on the cannabis becoming legal for recreational use for adults over 21 has been the enforcement of that cannabis. Already there are signs on Long State 17 that are warning drivers for driving under the influence and driving high, stating that if you are caught driving high and under the influence of cannabis, you will get ticketed. Another concern is that if a police officer does stop you, how can they test you on site for cannabis, as cannabis does have the long-lasting effects within the system? But things are fluid and things are ever-changing. You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Patricia Rabayo. Thank you again to Leah Mayo of The River Reporter, Chris Raleigh of the Shawangunk Journal, Joseph Abraham from the Sullivan County Democrat, and Philip Pontuso from the River Newsroom joining me for this edition of the Reporters Roundtable. Again, happy holidays and see you in the new year, where we will bring you more of the Reporters Roundtable. Stay safe.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Liza Phillips Design, sustainably sourced natural fiber rugs for floors and stairs, designed in Narrowsburg, handmade in Nepal. By appointment and on the web at LizaPhillipsDesign.com. From Jeffersonville Bake Shop, offering breakfast and lunch to go or to stay, Tuesdays through Sundays. Also featuring Chi Hive Yoga's gentle movement class in the event space. JeffersonvilleBakeShop.com.
I'm Manoush Zomorodi from NPR, and you are part of a community of public radio listeners. You hear the same stories and voices with your hearts beating as one. And when you give, you don't donate to this station alone either. It's your donation and the ones of so many others who hear what you do and feel inspired to support this NPR station. So listen to your heart. Here's how to give.
Give now at WJFFradio.org.
Sound familiar? And why, for the past 275 years, do audiences jump to their feet whenever, wherever those chords are sounded? Handel's Messiah, a soulful celebration with our special guest, pianist, singer, composer, Daryl Tukes, on The Janice Adams Show.
Saturday at noon on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville.
Support for Farm and Country comes from Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, a community-supported, science-based nonprofit, taking legal actions, providing tools for action, and raising awareness of fracking damage since 2008, proactively protecting public health in the Delaware River Basin and beyond. DamascusCitizens.org.
This is Rosie Starr for Radio Catskill. Welcome to Christmas on Farm and Country, locally produced radio about rural life in the Catskills and the Delaware River Valley. On today's show, Keith Hubbard's Star Talk report highlights the Star of Bethlehem. Christine San Jose spreads Christmas spirit as she recites the original poems of DJ Jan. Stephanie Phillips wraps up her conversation with Professor Dr. William Powell about the importance of the chestnut trees. All of that coming up on today's Farm and Country here on Radio Catskill. But first, news headlines from NPR.